I mean, I had here at the list of best articles a bunch about Christianity because I know you'll love that.
Oh, yes. I have some notes on that. But
Is America a More Christian Nation Than Ever Before by Robert Hampton. This is something that people have sent super chats to ask you before.
Okay.
Because apparently you have I think you are a pagan of some sort, but you also have a unique view of Christianity, which I don't really get it. I like to think of myself as Christian, but I'm also very open-minded when it comes to the perspectives of ancestral European faith, if we are going to call it that. So the notion is, of course, that even though fewer Americans call themselves Christians and fewer Americans are going to church, you know, and doing Christian things with their bodies, America is actually more Christian right now because it's more universalist, more egalitarian.
Mm-hmm.
Now, will you give us your position on this take?
I don't know. I think that's you know, there's certain, you know, I would say, you know, it's you know, like Thompson, I could make something up. there's a certain scholarly integrity that behind the idea of just saying, no, I don't have an idea. I'm still puzzling. It still puzzles me. The article about by Mr. Hampton, I thought was interesting because it raises an issue that I'm interested in, I'm not sure, but this may actually be in one of the comments. I think somebody named himself Vangrecht
commented.
Said, Christianity asserts an absolute equality in the eyes of God, but since the time of the early church fathers, the dangerous political consequences of this doctrine have been ablated by postponing matters until the hereafter. Radical leftism is inspired by similar zeal, but brooks no such temporizing with secular authority. All must be torn down in order that the elect, the anointed minorities, may usher in the Republic of Heaven. I apologize if that's actually from a comment. We should be talking about the article, but the question, but it addresses the key point here that early Christianity is pretty much leftism, you know. You know, the early Christians were sitting around, you know, because this is what St. Paul would say is the prick here. This is what pricks me here. The standard thing on the right of we need more Christianity. Christianity will solve our problems, and Christianity is about family values and stuff and so on. The early Christians were not like that at all. I see Mr. Nix has disappeared from my screen. Don't know what that's all about.
I'm still here in spirit.
Okay. But anyway. The original Christians didn't think like that. They expected Christ to return very quickly, and they largely preached a doctrine that's not particularly friendly to leftists, but embodies all that kind of universalism. And that's why I've written several articles about Brother Stair, an apocalyptic prophet who died last year down in South Carolina. He's a living embodiment of real early Christianity. And it's a doctrine of, you know, quit your job, get rid of your credit cards, get rid of debt, don't own a car because you have to take out an auto loan, don't own a house because you have to have a mortgage. This is all tying you to the world, and the world is run by Satan. And if that means you have to divorce your wife, get rid of her. What does it profit a man to gain the whole world and lose his soul? If your children don't like it, get rid of them. Everyone has to come down to his commune in South Carolina and live a simple Amish-like farming life. No cars, no phones, no TV. This is all Satan. And some of this is very much something the right would enjoy, you know, get rid of your TV, that sort of thing. Some of it is sound economic advice. Don't go into debt. the COVID thing has raised the whole question of have nothing to do with modern medicine. That's also the devil. It's witchcraft. God is the only one who sends health and illness. Illness is punishment. Pray and God may forgive you and cure you. That's very popular now, with the anti-COVID vaccination thing and the mark of the beast and all that. But anyway, my point is that this all had to be junked as Christ didn't come. And you can see in the Gospels as they gradually made accommodation with Satan and the world. And Christianity became world-friendly and family-friendly and so on. They started talking about, rules for marriage and how to raise children and, slaves obey your masters and the powers that be are appointed by God and so on. And this eventually, of course, took over the Roman Empire and sort of inherited that. In the form of the Catholic Church. And then you had what James Russell called the Germanization of Christianity as it encountered paganism. And of course, Brother Stair will point out that the Roman Catholic Church and Lutheranism and all that are all pagan as far as he's concerned. And he's right because they incorporate all these pagan elements simply because they're not living on a farm waiting for Jesus to come next week. So if you think Jesus is going to come next week, then it doesn't make any sense to start a family or get an education or have modern medical treatments and things like that. Jesus is coming. Get ready. So my point is, that's really the kernel of Christianity. And that's very much leftist. It's everyone's equal, just like Gunnery Sergeant Ermey would say. And Stair is very much in that line. He denounces denominations. He denounces races. He denounces nations. That's all the devil's work. Right? You're not a white man. You're a Christian. Right? You're not a black man. You're a Christian.
Sounds very Gnostic, if I'm being honest. The world is evil. Everything is like, for example, we have here in Macedonia our very own Gnostic heresy, which we came up with all by ourselves. Bogomilism, right? Yeah. Which mutated into Catharism when it crossed over into the Catholic world from the Orthodox world. And it's really so drastically anti-world that the archpriest, the heresiarch, Bogomil, who was a priest, he cautioned his followers to either because if you have sex, you're going to bring new people into the world. Right. That's bad. So you have two choices, Gnostic man: either abstain from sex entirely, or engage in sodomy only, non-genitive sex. Right. Your choices are literally either you're a monk. Or it wasn't just, men having sex with men, but it was non-reproductive sex. Do not put the PP into the baby hotel. So this is really a schizophrenic worldview.
But notice it makes I don't know about the Bogomils and the Cathars for that matter on this issue.
And they shunned everything about the church.
Churches,
as an edifice, they had their meetings in simple houses or maybe caves because even houses are sinful, right?
Sinful. Jesus was a carpenter, man. Come on. But
the carpentry is of this world.
The key to this is the idea that Jesus is coming any day now, you see.
Right.
Because even if you're not anti-sex, remember in the old ancient world, having sex meant having children, right? I mean, they weren't very big on the contraception stuff and so on. So, it's really a question. They were not thinking in terms of Playboy-style recreational sex, right? I mean, it was like get married and have children, get married and have children. Well, no, because Jesus is coming in 2 weeks. It's ridiculous to start a family. It's like today, people say, I can't start a family. I got no money, no job. I'm living in my parents' basement.
Climate
change. Once people get tired of waiting for Jesus to come back, you start making these accommodations with the world, what was incorporated, you talk about sodomy and all that. I mean, what was incorporated into the Catholic Church was it's like any kind of political agreement, compromises and things. And they incorporated that celibacy in with the notion of monks and nuns. So I said, well, you know, if you want to do that, you're free to do that, but don't make everyone.
Monks and nuns wasn't really about celibacy. It was really about withdrawing from the world. And
well, that's what I'm saying. You could withdraw from the world, right?
It wasn't, we focus on the celibacy in the modern world because the dominant sin of our time is lust. But you're supposed to shun all of the worldly sins, really.
But, you know, the point here is you know, it's that's what makes it possible for people to think like that. I'm continuing to monitor Brother Stair's commune because to see how they make do with the fact that the prophet's dead and Jesus didn't come back. You know, what kind of modifications are they going to be making as they go forward? Because they haven't scattered to the winds. But anyway, drawing the point there, saying, you know, it may be something of an illusion that Christianity is really going to benefit us in conservative terms. If by conservative you mean something like, you know, the Roman Catholic Church, marriage and family and, having a job and things like that. People don't normally think of Christian being a real Christian as, you know, shun jobs, shun cars, don't get involved in the monetary system.
It's a phenomenon of the West. Here in the East, the monastic tradition is alive and well. We also have the tradition of the holy mystic, although that's more of a Russian thing, right? We don't really have it that so much in Macedonia. But the Yuradiv, the fool for Christ, is very characteristic of Russian Christianity, of Russian Orthodoxy, where... the monks give up everything, right? But they still live in a monastery. They sleep in beds. They live with people. Many of the Russian Yuradivs, the fools for Christ, they would shun clothes and decency. They would hang out with prostitutes and gamblers.
As did
and
Jesus.
They would be fools for Christ, right? Mm-hmm. They would behave foolishly, sleep with the dogs in the mud, naked in the winter. For Christ, it's a life of absolute self-denial that would make Diogenes of Sinope weep.
You know, I was just going to mention Diogenes because, of course, he wasn't really. What does it self-denial mean? Diogenes would masturbate in public, so he wasn't avoiding. I mean, he was not having sex with women, but so on. But I mean, he was pleasuring himself, and he said, "Would that I could get rid of my hunger by patting my belly."
Yeah, I've tried. It doesn't work.
It doesn't work. That book I reviewed on Countercurrents, get back to Countercurrents, called Judaizing Jesus, has a whole chapter on, was Jesus a cynic? That is to say, influence or
like Diogenes, right?
Like Diogenes and so on. Many of the craziest things that Jesus says, take no thought for the morrow, right? And so on, are sound like, in fact, Price has like several pages of actual parallels between crazy things Jesus says, like take no thought for the morrow and so on, or as Reverend Stair would say, you know, no job, no house. That's all from the cynics, or at least it's paralleled in the cynics. It may not be influenced by it. And it's possible to be influenced by it because that was the Hellenistic period and there were cynics wandering about in Palestine. Right?
People point this out that even if Jesus was Jewish, for which I don't think the evidence is pretty strong, but he would have been a Hellenized Jew because Galilee, if the Jews of Galilee were heavily Hellenized, they would have been in contact with they would have been under the Hellenistic empires for a very long time and in contact with the Hellenistic/Roman world at the time. Yeah. Jesus would have probably known about Aristotle, Plato, Diogenes of Sinope, Zeno, the Stoic, all of these people if he was properly educated.
Yeah. Well, speaking of education, an interesting thing that someone pointed out to me recently is everyone knows that the Gospels are written in Greek. And they sort of like shrug their shoulders and say, yeah, well, whatever. It was a Greek-speaking region, so they agree Greek. You didn't learn Greek just like we learn, you know, using a Duolingo app on our iPhones or something like that. You went to a school and they taught you, you know, Greek and Greek literature and Greek rhetoric and so on. So anyone who knew Greek didn't just know Greek. You didn't just pick it up. You could learn Greek today by just
Greek. The Greek of the Gospels is Koine Greek.
This
is a constructed language. Nobody really spoke this. This is not a folk language. This is a language I believe ordered constructed by either Alexander or Seleucus. I'm not sure, because he was ruling a bunch of city states and needed a common language. And, you know, he was Macedonian. He was speaking the ancient Macedonian language at home. He invented this whole new language for the use of in the empire. I'm not sure if this was Alexander or Seleucus, but Koine Greek is not a language you speak at home. It's a language you learn in order to enter imperial intellectual life. I mean, that the ancient Hellenistic East was basically, imagine if we had Esperanto, if you and I were speaking Esperanto today, because that's, Koine Greek is really like the Esperanto of its time.
Oh, yeah, yeah, very much.
It was not a dialect spoken by anyone at home.
You know, I can't pretend to be an expert on this, although I did learn Koine Greek. I learned it exactly the way I was just about to say. You could learn Koine Greek by just studying Koine Greek and the New Testament, nothing else but that. That's why I took it, because it was easier than real Greek. It was pidgin Greek. It was like Esperanto, right? But I'm not sure if it's exactly the case that no one ever spoke it, or it couldn't be. I mean, it has pronunciation. I mean, it has accent marks.
Nobody spoke it as a mother tongue.
Oh, yeah, yeah. What?
If you call your wife a cheating cunt, you don't do it in Koine Greek. You do it in your local dialect, right? That's it. I'm sorry. That's
This gets to a related issue, because for a long time, people thought, they literally taught this, that because, you know, Christians and ministers and priests were the people who were teaching Koine Greek. So they would teach you that Koine was a special dialect that the Holy Spirit had devised, especially for the communication of deep spiritual truths. That's why it was different from the other kinds of Greek. Because this was
Alexander was awesome, but he was not this Holy Spirit.
Right. So this is what they taught, and this is what people more or less thought. It wasn't until they uncovered a huge cache of business receipts and personal correspondence written in Koine when they realized, wait a second, people were actually using this in merchant transactions and things like that, which makes sense if you think of the fishermen. You know, in Galilee, they would have had some notion of Koine, right? They might have dealt with receipts and bills and things like that. So I'm not sure. Even an ordinary fisherman might have some kind of Koine. I mean, he could read a sign. He could look at a bill and say, what do you mean this bill for services rendered? Well, he can read the word services rendered in Koine, you know, so he could read and speak it in that sense. You didn't necessarily have to go to school, but it was something you went to a school for. That's the key issue here. Aramaic was the common language that everybody spoke. Jesus spoke in Aramaic. Paul probably knew Hebrew, since he's supposed to have been a big shot rabbi. It's weird that Jesus is shown reading from the Torah at a couple of places. It's odd that he would know Hebrew. Bar mitzvah boys today, they only learn one little passage in Hebrew, which they read. It's all just a ceremonial thing. Right? But in Jesus' day, apparently,
they speak a modern variant over in Israel, or should.
They have their own modern variant. But I mean, like your ordinary Long Island kid, he gets bar mitzvah, he memorizes a passage, and then they pretend that he's reading the Torah, and that now he is a man. But apparently in Jesus' day, you were expected to sort of like be able to read the whole thing, because they give him like a random passage, which of course Jesus turns into a parable, right? Because he's Jesus, you know, he can teach all kinds of stuff, right? And they're all amazed at his wisdom. Or even when he was 12 years old, he was debating in the temple with the other people. So he must have been referring to. But of course, the book that Jesus quotes is always from the Septuagint, the Greek translation. Interestingly enough, even though they show him reading the Torah in the synagogue. So apparently its claim seems to be the new classical Greek, which is what the Septuagint is in. I don't think it's in Koine. And Hebrew, apparently. And of course, he spoke Aramaic. Well, you know, he's largely a fictional character anyway. I mean, this is all fictional elaboration, you know, like George Washington chopping down a cherry tree, or Lincoln being born in a log cabin.
It's not beyond the ken that people will speak, like, especially if they're in a sort of, this is a multi-ethnic, multicultural area. they can grow up to become trilingual, especially if one of those languages, like basically everyone in the world who is exposed to the internet speaks English now, because it's a very simple language to learn and you have immense immersion, right? So I say people speak, well, how many languages do you speak? I say subtract English, because everyone does that.
But the point I wanted to get at, though, in introducing this topic is what I just recently learned or heard from some guy with a PhD, so it probably must be true, is that you would have had to have learned, you know, essentially Greek literature. You would have learned through reading Homer. You would have learned through reading all these people. So when these people wrote these books, they weren't just, if you think that the Apostle John wrote the Gospel of John, which he probably didn't. But if you think like that, think, well, John would have learned Koine somehow, in that area. It's not impossible. And that's why he writes in Greek. But if he had learned Koine, he would have learned all kinds of Greek literature, right? So it's and the same with all these other people. The mere fact that they're writing in Koine doesn't mean that the only thing they ever read was the other guys in the New Testament. That's the point I'm making. You could learn Koine today by just reading the New Testament, but that's not how they read it, because, of course, they hadn't written the New Testament yet. They learned Greek literature, actual Greek literature. So it's not surprising, although it surprises a lot of people, that there's all kinds of Greek literary myths and motifs in the Gospels, right? Stories that are obviously based on Greek myths, stories that are based on Greek literature. That's another thing.
If the Gospels present an accurate picture of Greek, of Jesus' ministry, it means he also spoke to an audience which he expected to know to resonate with these motifs and figures. This is another thing to take into consideration.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
This is just... Yeah.
Well, yes and no. I mean, we know, especially in the Gospel of Mark. See, getting back to what I was saying about Jesus didn't come back, right? Mm-hmm. So by the time the Gospels are written, they've adjusted to this, right? They admit, the guy's not coming back. You know, he's not coming back next week. Maybe he'll come back in 2,000 years, but we don't know. So, for instance, you have Peter in his epistle, which he didn't write. But you have Peter saying, don't you know that to the Lord, a day is as 1,000 years and 1,000 years is as a day? Oh, so you mean he was trolling us, in other words. He said he would be back in a few days. He really meant a couple thousand years because we're stupid. I mean, that's an obvious quote.
Probably off crashing into a Cadillac with Clarence Thomas.
That's an example of a cope, right? As we would say today, right? That's his cope. But anyway, in the Gospel of Mark, the problem here is there's an issue of something like, for instance, the Messianic secret, right? When did Jesus know he was the Messiah? Did he start off knowing he was the Messiah? In the Gospel of Mark, it seems that he becomes the Messiah when he gets baptized by John, and the heavens open up, and it is announced, "This is my son." Right? Jesus didn't need to be told that, I suppose, but maybe he did. Certainly, the audience is being told that. This is my son. In other accounts, Jesus, if you read Paul's epistles, in many of the epistles, it seems as if Jesus becomes the Messiah after he's resurrected. That's what makes him the Messiah, right? He's just an ordinary guy. He's crucified and boom, God raises him from the dead. And because he suffered so much and so on, he passed the test, unlike Adam who failed the test. And so he's glorified and brought up to heaven and named Jesus. That's where he gets the name Jesus from, right? And placed at the right hand.
He's named Christ. He's already Christ, named Jesus.
Yes, Christ. Yeah. All will bow before this name and so on, et cetera. He gets the name after he's resurrected, right? He wasn't the Messiah until then. So there's this issue of the Messianic secret. Now, in the Gospel of Mark, you were talking about the audience he's writing for. The Gospel of Mark, the apostles and the crowds are portrayed as being dummies, right? They don't get it, right? They don't understand it. And so he tells them these things, but they don't get it, he tells them parables. And then the apostles say, why are you telling them in these parables? He said, well, because they're not supposed to know the truth. Well, what about us? We're your disciples. Oh, to you, I'll reveal it.
Right.
So even in the Gospels, he's portrayed as misleading people, at least in the sense that he doesn't expect them to understand what he's saying. Which also gets into the whole issue of things like the Transfiguration, which is in Mark. Mark doesn't have a resurrection story. Mm-hmm. It just ends with the tomb. But he does have the Transfiguration. The Transfiguration is his version of the resurrection story, right? And it's a secret resurrection, just with Peter and John. And this is to explain the passages of where did Jesus reveal himself? Oh, he revealed himself to Peter. You remember when he was on the mountain and had the Transfiguration? Oh, yeah. I guess that's why Peter's in charge of the church, isn't it? Yeah, right. Now you're talking. So you have all these motifs. The one I wanted to point out was the story in Luke about Paul on the road to Damascus, which is clearly based on Euripides. This is in the Bacchae, where the king who denies the new god, who's Dionysus, which of course is Jesus, with the wine and all that, and he comes from the east. He's a new god. The king rejects him, doesn't want to have anything to do with him, and then he has this blinding visitation from the god. There are all kinds of little motifs that pop up in here. Speaking of which, I just wanted to mention one thing to get back to articles that were in Countercurrents. That very interesting article by Catherine S. about the two fires.
Hold your horses there, Mr. O'Meara. We're still on the Christian thing.
Well, this is kind of Christian.
We'll get to that.
Okay. We'll hold on.
But okay. Sorry to cut you off.
No, I just want to say, well, if we're going to get back to it, we'll get back to it, so I don't have to bring it up. But there's a photo in there of the statue of Helios. I associated that with the article of Jack Murphy teaching about sociopaths, because he mentions Richard Spencer. And it occurred to me, that statue of Helios looks like Richard Spencer.
Well, so, that would flatter Mr. Spencer very greatly.
Yeah, exactly. That's Richard Spencer as he sees himself. Just as that's supposed to be Nero as he sees himself as the sun god.
It's one of those things, yeah. But I'm going to say nobody of us has a realistic appraisal of ourselves. I don't really see myself as the sun god, but yes, I do. I don't know if you've caught my appearance on Millennial, where I'm with the Macedonian flag positioned in such a way that the rays of the starburst seem to be crowning me. So that's very conscious. People... Well, at first it was accidental, but then every time I position myself like that, it boosts my ego. I was thinking about this really when I was thinking about perception, a little sneak peek into the future for everyone listening. There will be an article coming in about how we allow our perception of things to be colored by the enemy, but primarily by our own narcissism. I was thinking about how we were talking about Seinfeld, of course, this phenomenon of Red America, which is very Zionist and loves the Jews and loves Israel and God blesses those that bless Israel. But these people find Seinfeld alienating. They find Judaism as it is alienating. And they just don't engage with the Jews as they are. And there is this Jewish producer woman on Twitter who said, that basically Red America has a problem with seeing Jews as they are, as human beings, rather than as props in a Christian morality play. That's her exact words. And I can't help but agree with that.
Yeah.
See, I don't think Red America wants to engage with the Jews as they really are. I think that ironically, we who are the open and declared anti-Semites actually do see the Jews as they are. I mean, I don't keep stay up at night checking for Jews under my bed. I'm an anti-Semite because I'm willing to look the Jew in the eye and see him as he really is, right?
Yes.
Yeah. I'm not making caricatures of monstrous people here. I'm observing a people as they are, or try to. You know, of course, my perception is going to be colored by my own narcissism and everything, and not just because I'm a narcissistic person. I'm going to look at everything through the prism of everything that is my own identity, right?
Yeah.
This is a human universal. You do not escape the confines of what you are as a thing, you know, as an observer as well. There is no such thing as a view from nowhere. No?
So of course,
the Christian Zionist Red State American is going to see the Jews from a Christian Red State Zionist American point of view. He has no other way of doing it. It takes an immense capacity for self-denial, splitting, schizophrenia, whatever the fuck we're going to call it these days, you know? Because the thing. When you were talking about the Brother Steer guy, he's not a jolly fellow, whereas Diogenes of Sinope strikes me as a very jolly fellow, you know? I am the Emperor Alexander. What will you have me do for you? Get out of my son. You're blocking out my son. I'm trying to work on a tan over here.
You know, brother Stir, you mentioned humorous. He's not, of course. But I find him.
You know, Diogenes, he's a funny guy. You know,
Plato's a funny guy. Just the way he tells the story, he's a funny guy.
A man is a featherless biped. I have just plucked a chicken here. Behold, it's a man. Because Diogenes is Jewish.
Everyone's Jewish.
Yes, and Plato's Italian, though.
Plato's
like, hey, see, man is like a featherless pipe. I'm sorry. Go on.
But Brother Stair, he's a very angry man. It's interesting, since his death, they've been playing like really been playing like decades worth of old material. And you can really hear the difference as the years go by. He gets more and more cranky, which is what attracted me to him in the first place. He's just hilariously cranky, you know. It's like, no, Catholics aren't going to be saved. They're damned! Damned, all of them! You're all damned! And he gets really worked up. It's just hilarious. I love listening to him. But yeah, he's not a happy guy. He's not a happy... He has the word in English... cynical. He's a guy with a cynical approach to it, and some of the stuff Jesus does is.
But the original article, I believe, Emil Cioran calls Diogenes the Celestial Hound.
Okay.
Yeah, because he's dog-like Diogenes. Now I've been around a lot of dogs. They are jolly fellows. Right? That's the best thing about dogs. They're not cranky. I mean,
but someone like Brother Stair would say, in defiance of the way he obviously is, he would say, you know, well, of course, everything with these evangelicals is all about joy and happiness, but it's true joy, true happiness, not your disgusting materialistic happiness, driving your big car, going out to church, and then you go out to have brunch and stuff your guts. He gets really worked up about these things, you know, Halloween, dressing up like demons and teaching the children how to be ghosts.
There's video of this guy?
Yeah, there are probably videos around. Yeah, you can. Yeah. Go to rgstare.com. But anyway, this guy, so many videos of this guy, he actually posted on his own YouTube channel a video of him during a service when he was fondling a 12-year-old girl's breasts. Which is what got him in trouble.
Brother Steer?
Yeah. That's what got him in trouble.
I thought the internet was of the devil.
Well, again, this is great. Of course, like all these guys, he's an exception, right? So he can have air conditioning, but nobody else can have air conditioning. for instance, because he's 88 years old. But nevertheless, he has air conditioning. He can use the internet. In fact, that's his whole thing is using the shortwave and the internet to broadcast to the entire world and thereby bring about the apocalypse, right? Because it says when the gospel is brought to the entire world, then will Jesus come. So, interestingly, he was once watching some pornography in his radio room, as he calls it, and he accidentally turned a switch and accidentally started broadcasting the pornography on his channel. So he got caught with this. So he denied it. And then when they forced him to admit it, he said, as St. Paul says, I can take the strong meat, but you can't. You know, I can just inform myself of what this pornography is like and so on. And I'm safe, you know, but you, of course, would be corrupted by it. You see,
the strong meat.
The strong meat. Yeah. There's an organization of ex-members that tracks him. That's called rgstare.com. Go there and do the search on strong meat, and you'll hear the whole thing. But yeah, you know, as in most of these cults. But I have to say, other than being a sexual predator,
was he really?
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know.
Okay.
Again, he would say, you know, well, you just read that on the internet. That's the devil's. You know. Okay. But anyway, leaving that aside, I have to say, you know, he did walk the walk. He didn't just talk the talk. You know, he was not some guy who, you know, raked in millions of dollars and wore fancy suits and drove big cars and that. Because of course he keeps denouncing that, right? You know, he lived on the farm with everyone else. You know, he had air conditioning maybe, but, you know, otherwise, you know, he's down there on the farm. So he really lived that life, you know, Diogenes-like. In fact, he's very much like Diogenes because apparently he would assault women by demanding oral sex. So it's kind of like Diogenes with his public masturbation sort of thing and so on, right? That's the strong.
Well, Diogenes performed his own labor.
Well, yeah, yeah, yeah. But I mean, in other words, he wasn't above, you know, getting his jollies, as it were. But if only they were honest about it. See, that's the problem with the Christians. They can't be honest about it. You know, I mean, if he was like Diogenes, and that's where they differ, you see. I mean, there's this like this phony righteousness to these people. You know, if Jesus was really a cynic, then, you know, we would have a very different form of Christianity if we emphasize the cynic version. Now, you know, Price's book, Judaizing Jesus, is about how they're trying, you know, scholars are trying to force this idea of Jesus being a Jew. You know, he's like really a rabbi, you know. And he claims that this distorts our understanding of the history. And they do this for political reasons because, you know, they want to further Jewish-Christian understanding. Fight anti-Semitism.
They want to meme Judeo-Christianity into being.
Yeah. Yeah. So he presents alternate versions of Jesus that are just as legitimate, if not more so, one of which is the cynical Jesus. So if Jesus was really turned, if we interpreted Jesus rather than being a rabbi and tie him with the Old Testament messianic prophecies and stuff, if we cut all that stuff out and just had the Jesus the cynic, imagine what Christianity would be like. You see, that's my basic point here. What would Christianity
be like? Really look like the Russian Christianity of the Yuridivs, right?
Because the fools for Jesus?
Yeah, fools. The fools for Christ. Yeah. See, that's the thing. I see from my observations really of Christianity and all of its dispositions, where people say, oh, orthodoxy is based. I usually, you know, point and laugh at people like that because it's usually people with no experience with the Orthodox Church. I have some pretty horrendous stories of corruption and degeneracy just from the Macedonian Orthodox Church. The Russians provide much more than that. They are, we are an older civilization, but they are much bigger than us. So, you know, size matters. So it's the law of large numbers, I would say.
Uh-huh.
And however, there is a kernel of truth in it that for whatever reason, Orthodox Christianity retains pre-Socratic thought within itself, which has been very thoroughly purged from the West for, I don't know, we can get into the reasons why, but I think the reason is that the West really worships the god of Neoplatonists and just calls him Jesus, whereas the East, the pre-Socratic thought came from the East itself, so it cannot be expunged. You cannot expunge Diogenes. You cannot expunge Thales. You cannot expunge all of these philosophers. And yeah, there is Plato. There is Aristotle in the East. But they are co-equal with all of these other interpretations of Christianity. So there's, that's something to think about.
You know, off the top of my head, I would have said that the Eastern Church was full of Neoplatonism and so on.
Yeah, of course it is. All of Christianity is full of Neoplatonism.
Oh, yeah. But, right. but as opposed to the West, where you have that layer of Aristotelianism and Thomism and so on, right? Whereas, you know, this is how the Eastern Church gets presented here in the West. They say, well, you know, the Eastern Church preserved much of the original spiritual loyalty of the Greeks and Plotinus and people like that, and it was Augustine.
Well, Plotinus was not a Greek origin. He belongs more strongly to Magian civilization than Greek civilization.
Oh yeah,
classical civilization. Yeah.
See, well, I mean, this is how it's presented. You know, I mean, this is the story you get. You know that the Greek church. You know, for instance, Fridtjof Schwann tried to, in transcendent unit of religions and so on. This is the argument that the perennialists like Schwann had with Abel and Gainon, that was there an authentic initiatory tradition in Christianity, or was Christianity just a phony baloney religion from the start? And Abelov's says that Schwann, in order to advance this idea, alludes to minor traditions in the Eastern Church, and the hesychasts, or however that's pronounced, the Jesus prayer sort of people and so on, the Philokalia, stuff like that. But he dismisses that as a minor tradition in the Eastern Church, right? The rest of Christianity never had any kind of. We don't have to argue about this issue, but I'm just bringing this out as this is the sort of thing people will say. You know, oh, you want real spirituality, you have to go to the Eastern Church because they preserve the original traditions. And in the Western Church, it was all, quasi secularized, and that's why Protestantism rose and secularism and so on in the West. They lost the original spiritual stream that's still there.
I've heard arguments, and they're pretty sound, by Orthodox theologians that what the West did with Protestantism, we did with Islam. That basically Islam is nothing but a very strong, very persistent Christological heresy, and it's a heresy of the Orthodox faith, of the Eastern Orthodox faith.
Really? Really? Yes, I've heard the Christian heresy thing, but I didn't know it was considered from the Orthodox faith.
Right. It's
interesting.
I'm not a theologian, so I cannot really speak authoritatively to this, but it appears true. It would appear that basically a group of Christian Messalian heretics strongly influenced Muhammad and his thinking in Mecca. And Mecca is, I believe, at the time a Jewish town, or was it Medina? Or both were Jewish cities, right?
Everyone's
Jewish over there.
Yeah,
I mean, this is all deep Semitic territory. These are all Semites, so they're all Semites.
Deep Semitism. Right. Yes,
and so we did this, you did that. Let bygones be bygones.
Bygones be bygones.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's interesting. As to the whole orthodoxy is based thing, I see so much degeneracy and corruption, and just plain old corruption, as in the bishop ruining a very popular abbot of a monastery because the abbot was drawing more faithful than him. It's petty and it's disgusting. And if the goal is to get people into churches, it's self-defeating. So, but what are you going to do?
That's interesting. I mean, I don't know what these people mean by when they say the orthodoxy is base, but off the top of my head, it wouldn't be in the sense that they're free from corruption or anything like that. But I mean, the thing that pops into my head is that unlike the Western Church, which, to get to our earlier discussion, is very much propounds this kind of universalism. Neither Jew nor Gentile, and all that stuff. It eventually becomes woke stuff and so on. The Eastern Church, obviously, it seems to me, is an outsider and ignorant of all these traditions, obviously seems to me to have been rather comfortable with the idea of having different national churches. With, you know, that was the whole split between the East and the West, right? The idea that the Pope had sole authority. This Bishop of Rome had the only authority. Whereas in the East, you had a more
council. Which is invented out of whole cloth, this idea of the authority of the Bishop of Rome. However, I will caution that the glaring exception is the largest church, which is the Russian Orthodox Church. It will take anyone from anywhere.
Oh, really?
Because it's, yeah, I mean, in the East, you have a bunch of national identities. And theoretically, all of the Orthodox churches will take anyone from anywhere. They take converts. But the Russian church actively seeks them out because Russian national identity is subsumed into Russian imperial identity. And those two are very different categories.
See, what
Russian is all. Russian is a biological category, but it's also a political category. And the political category far outstrips the biological category.
But what I mean is simply having national. I mean, you know, I guess it's like Judaism. You know, I mean, if you're an Irishman and you become a Jew, you know, you convert to Judaism. Well, racially, you're not Jewish. You know, but you know, the same thing here. I mean, they can take converts. But what I'm thinking is that you have different national churches, and are the liturgies different? I mean, they're all in Greek. I don't think so.
No.
Slavonic and so on. You know, you have all that. Whereas in the West, of course, you initially had the Catholic Church, which was, you know, everything was in Latin. There was one ruler, blah, blah, blah. You know, then, of course, you have the Protestants breaking off, and then they immediately break out into 365 different denominations and so on. You know, Brother Stair, brother, see, this is the sort of thing. See, I use Brother Stair as my litmus test for, you know, original Christianity. So he would denounce.
You're telling me this story, but I'm reminded of the God Hates Fags guys, I think. Because this is the same thing, right?
I just heard Reverend Stair say this again this morning as I was listening to him. This is his whole thing. You know, he has no interest in homosexual faggots, as he calls them. But he says,
but regular
are homosexual faggots the worst people on earth? No, they're not. Thought of that. It's a sin, but so is gluttony. So is this, that, and the other thing. And so on, right? You people with your auto loans, don't you know that Jesus says that he who takes a loan becomes a slave? And you can serve no two masters, right? Are you a slave of mammon or a slave of Jesus? If you own a car with a car loan, you're a sinner. Right? Did you know shopping is a sin? Did you know Halloween is a sin? These are all sins. We are all sinners, right? There is no Jew or Gentile. We are all sinners. The homosexual is no worse than any other kind of sinner. The problem with these homosexuals is they won't admit that they're sinners, and therefore they will be damned. Because unless you admit you are a sinner, you cannot be saved. So yeah, so
that's
so,
very eloquent. That's Arlie Ermy territory.
Yeah.
He gets equally damned.
Yeah, exactly. And that's what we're talking about. This is the original Christianity. We're all sinners. We're all equally damned. So Brother Stair would like most Westerners, he barely knows anything about Orthodoxy, the Eastern Church. But you know, the problem with the Roman Catholic Church is it's the horror of Babylon, right? It's all paganism. The problem with the Protestants is that there are all these denominations. You know, you are a Christian. You are not an Episcopalian. You are not a Baptist and so on. And he would probably say the same thing about the Orthodox. He said, it's just a bunch of different churches. Don't belong to a church. You belong to the body of Christ.
I think we would also fall into horror Babylon territory because, you know, have you ever seen the Orthodox pageantry? We're worse than the Catholics.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. All that would work. But what
it's,
I'm saying
it's not, is really not. It's not. I wouldn't even call it orthodoxy. It's orthopraxy. Belief is less important than practicing the rituals.
You know, that's interesting because that's what Israel Shahak says about Judaism.
Right.
That what matters is practice rather than belief. And
this is a characteristic of ancient faith, as we discussed it last week with Catherine S. I don't know if you caught the that show. But the ancient faith of the ancient city, as described by Numa Denis Fustel de Coulanges, was what was important is that you get the rituals right,
Right.
And belief didn't really enter into the, it's important to get the ritual right. You got to get the right formula. You got to give the right sacrifice, the right funerary repast for your dead father. Otherwise he's going to come up back as a restless mane and probably upend your teapot or something. It's one of these things.
This is what
Jesus. This is something that, and Judaism is a religion which comes from that period as well.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah, that's Shahak says that you shouldn't call them Orthodox Jews because orthodoxy is not a concept in Judaism. Of course, in Europe they're called traditional Jews. You know, the guys with the long sideburns and stuff like that, right? The beaver.
Yeah, hats. The Jew Jews.
The right? Jews,
not the commie liberal Jews. Yeah, the Jew exactly. Jews, right? Right.
Yeah. In America, they're called Orthodox Jews. And he says, well, that's not really the case because it's not about belief. An Orthodox Jew will pray next to a Chabad mystic because they're both praying the right prayer in Hebrew, even though the Chabad mystic thinks that he's helping Yahweh have sex with the Shekinah in order to further creation, right? That doesn't matter to the Orthodox Jew. He's saying the right words in the right order, right? But that Orthodox Jew will not pray with a conservative Jew or a liberal Jew, even though they may share the same beliefs about God, you know, because they don't pray in Hebrew, right? Now, this is exactly what Jesus condemned.
Hey, aren't they supposed to not speak in Hebrew until the Messiah comes?
I haven't heard that.
Because there's like an Israeli joke about, I guess they call them Orthodox Jews over there too.
Yeah, we'll call them.
Right, because so an Israeli, like a regular Israeli
guy,
right? It's one of those bog standard Israeli Jews who they don't act like Jews at all. He's walking by, he's talking on his cellular phone, and he's speaking in Hebrew, right? Modern Hebrew. And then one of these Shabbat cultists or what do they call them? Orthodox Jews with the curls and the hat. He starts screaming at him in Yiddish about how the Messiah has not yet arrived and therefore he shouldn't speak in Hebrew. And furthermore, the regime in Tel Aviv is heretical and demonic. And besides his welfare is late. Yeah, people are in the chat are saying Hasidic, right? Yeah. And then the Israeli guy is like pushes the Jew away and says, fucking tourists. Because the guy is speaking in Yiddish probably sounds like German to this guy.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah, they do look like tourists. I mean, all you have to do is look at those people and you can
see
they
look like fucking aliens.
Yeah, well, they look like aliens. That's true. But they certainly don't look like they belong in the Middle East. I mean, they're dressed like Polish merchants of the 16th century, right? I mean, they're obviously Poles. Right.
Merchants.
Yeah. Well, exactly. Yeah, but the point is, they're obviously not Semites. No Semite dresses like that. Look at how the Arabs dress with the flowing robes and all that. Right. That's dressed for a hot climate. Right. These guys are dressed for a Polish winter. It doesn't make any fucking sense. They're wearing fur hats for Christ's sake. But I want to point out that's what Jesus was talking about. He was condemning the Jews of his time, who are the Pharisees, who became the standard Jew today. He was condemning the Pharisees for that reason. Although it's not, you're right, it's not common, it's not unique to Pharisees. This is the whole system is like that. You care about washing your hands.
What the Romans were, right? The argumentation between early Christians and Romans, like they could worship at the imperial cult. But we don't believe this. Neither do I.
What do you think
the emperor thinks he's a god?
that's
something we do as Roman subjects.
Yeah. Until Nero and Caligula, when they actually did start to think they were gods. But yeah.
Yeah, but we don't talk about those.
We don't talk about that. Oh, is it Commodus, I think, was... I was watching a YouTube thing about him, and apparently he was the first emperor who actually believed he was a god, which is one reason why they had to get rid of him.
Thought he was a great entertainer.
Well, he did that too. But eventually that was not enough.
That's actually worse. That's like, because the Romans, they had their entertainment, in the Colosseum. It still comes off as somewhat manly in the film, in Gladiator. But a modern-day Commodus would be like the president of America who insists on portraying Hamilton in the musical. I guess Brandon's going to want to do that next.
Yeah, every now and then you'll find the video of someone like John Kerry dancing at some Harlem gathering or something like that, you know, getting down with the people, you know, that sort of thing.
I just had a vision of Hillary Clinton singing Springtime for Hitler.
You know what? You have to be honest, though, that was Trump. I mean, Trump was a reality show guy, and he kept being a reality show guy as president. So, I mean, there may be something to the idea of him disgracing the office, as it were. But, you know, from that point of view.
Well, in the sense that.
Tweeting all day long, you know, I mean, sitting in his office tweeting.
Yeah, that there is a, like, and they accuse us, the far right, of being, you know, incels, living in our mother's basement, doing nothing except sit on the internet. Well, that was our leader for 4 years, right? He was sitting there.
Yeah, but he had a hot Eastern European
White House
wife.
Basement, hiding from the BLM, tweeting about law and order.
Yeah, yeah, but the difference is he had Melania, so.
Yes, right.
You know, as somebody was talking about transsexuals and stuff like that, and it's kind of about, you know, the subject of having breast implants and things like that. And somebody, it's quoted an old joke from somewhere. But anyway, if you know, if I had a chest like that, I'd never leave the house, you know. So that's, you know, if I had a wife like Melania, I wouldn't leave the house either. I mean, that's my kind of basement dwelling. But anyway.
We have donations.
Okay, yes.
Right.
Today.
I'm sorry to report that entropy seems to be on the fritz.
Oh.
But I do remember that ABC donated $10 and asked about, what about the good Jews, specifically Enrico Fermi's wife and Eric Zemmour in France? Well, this is why I asked James if Mel Brooks is one of the good ones, because I want to keep enjoying those films, even though they're chock full of degeneracy.
Yeah,
you see, yeah. They are a funny people. They amuse us. They make
us
laugh.
People.
I mean,
they're funny people.
This is realistic.
Well, they see. There's two elements to this. I mean, you're sort of getting at it with the idea of the chock full of degeneracy and so on. I mean, you can say, this is what I'm trying to say. You can distinguish between the question of this is often asked. Do Jews have a role in white nationalism, right? Can we let them join our club? You know, but you.
Well, it's like a question of does the flu have a role in the immune response?
Well, yeah, natural immunity and all that. No, but the idea is, you know, so some Jew, you know, like say Paul Gottfried, for instance, or somebody like that, you know, says, you know, yeah, I think you guys are right. Or, you know, I want to make some, contribute some articles, write some books, speak at your conferences, you know, et cetera, et cetera. You know, can they talk the talk at least, you know? If somebody's writing a book and it's pro-white nationalism, I don't particularly care if he's a Jew or not, you know? You know, it's like every now and then, you know, they'll find some Holocaust narrative is fictional, or the person writing it wasn't even a Jew, somebody writing a book about, you know, supposedly as a female author. There's a French writer, I think, or an Italian writer who was very famous, won awards and so on. It's supposed to be a woman, turned out to be a man. Not a transsexual, but I mean, pretending to be a woman, writing with a woman's name and all that.
Yeah, and that Indian from the advertisements about pollution, he turned out to be Italian.
Well, there you go, another Italian.
Well, and everyone
all fits
that.
Together. But yeah, you know, I mean, that wouldn't lead me to think, oh, this book must have been a trick of some kind. It could have been. It could have been, you know, and you can look at this stuff you know, you can see where, oh, you see where the Jew is trying to steer you in this way and so on. You know, a more blatant example is this Hazzoni guy with his Burke Institute and then so on. And clearly this is like a Jewish neocon who's trying to co-opt white nationalism. Yeah, exactly.
Fellow nationalists.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So that guy is clearly, I mean, I don't see how anyone could be fooled. I mean, that guy is clearly. Then you have somebody like Zemmour and you think, well, you know, maybe what he's doing is he's trying to split the vote on the right. Clearly, he's more interested in getting rid of Muslims than really advancing white interests. So, you know, maybe that's his angle. You know, maybe the Jews want realize this too much of this Islam stuff is going to be dangerous. We have to, you know, we're trying to dilute the white stuff, but there's too much of the Islam stuff now. It's dangerous, too. So we'll get this Zamor guy and he'll be able to attack the Muslims.
There was a recent test of his willingness to attack the Muslims, right? He was asked by some activist for the right, he frames it as rights of animals. But this guy's organization is fighting against cruelty to animals and butchery, right? He's fighting against halal and kosher butchery,
right?
What he's doing. Yeah. And he asks Zamor flat out, are you going to pass laws which restrict cruelty to animals, cruel butchery of animals, right?
Yeah.
And Zamor just dithers and prevaricates. And this is a guy who's very quick on his feet. He's always got a ready answer. It's like, oh, it's a complex issue. You can't do that. And so the libtard journalist writing about this event says, the guy didn't get it, but Zamor got it. And I got it. He's asking him if he's French or Jewish. And, you know, the lack of answer, the prevaricating, dithering answer from Zamor is very clear. He's a Jew. He's not French. Because French people do not torture animals. Well, except the ducks with the foie gras. But who gives a shit about ducks anyways?
Well, you know,
I'm sorry to take that back. I love ducks. I love ducks. I love foie gras, too. And,
well, but you see the brilliance of the question.
The thing, you know, he's asking him, are you willing to prohibit cruelty to animals? It's going to hurt Muslims pretty bad. Let's not, because if you cannot do halal butchery, they can't eat meat, right? Well, but neither can the Jews.
Right.
Yeah, they depend on kosher.
Yeah. It's a brilliant question because it finds an issue that would hurt Jews as much as Muslims, right? You know, immigration, you know,
even intended. I think the guy who was there, he was a Zamor supporter, and he earnestly thinks that the cruelty to animals angle is a way to fight Islam. And it is. If we enforce cruelty to animal laws and end religious exception to them, we can solve the Muslim question in Europe.
Yeah, that's also the final solution to the Jewish problem as well.
It is, right. Well, they're going to have to become vegetarians like all those Hollywood Jews.
Well, you know, I don't know about Islam. You know, Jews have a whole culture where they because of the separation of meat and milk, they have this whole vegetarian sort of aspect to their cuisine. So there's all kinds of Jewish vegetarian food.
Right. So wait, if I want to scare a Jew, I just show them a cheeseburger.
Well, yeah, you can do that.
Okay.
Yeah, no cheeseburgers. But that's the issue in a nutshell, right? You got the cheese on the hamburger, but there have always been vegetarian restaurants, and it also because of the kosher problem, because of course being Jews, they're neurotic, right? So they can never trust it, right? You never. I once had a job. I was working at. In the what's called the development office, and I was fundraising for a law school in New York, and we were there's some occasion when we would throw these events which were basically shakedowns, you know, to get rich guys to donate money, and so it was a lot of schmoozing. You know, we'd hold cocktail parties and banquets and things like that. Make the alumni happy if they were rich alumni. And there was one place where one of the guests, one of the big shots and so on, this woman, she had demanded a kosher meal. And we were like, okay, yeah, fine. Okay, kosher meal, no problem. It's New York, right? It's not a problem. We can get a kosher meal, right? Turned out that the kosher certification was not a company that she agreed with, right? You know, the idea, two Jews, three opinions, right? So it's not enough that it's just kosher. It's got the little U in the circle symbol. She doesn't like that certification. She wants another certification for it, right? So these people, and as I muttered under my breath at the time to my boss, this is what Jesus was talking about. This is what Jesus was talking about. But my point is that they're so paranoid about this that they don't trust the certification. So some Jews actually will, if they're not certain about a restaurant, they'll go to a vegetarian restaurant, you know? And there are actually special Jewish vegetarian restaurants, certainly in New York, for that very reason, because they don't have to worry about the kosher thing, right? Mm-hmm. At least as far as the meat goes. There's all kinds of kosher rules, I mean, you know, but apparently the vegetarian, if they can just be vegetarian, they can get by. They can get by. You know, there's all kinds of workarounds and copes. Right? It's really, so like you were saying before, it's all about going through the motions. You know, as long as you go through the motions. And
it's one of these. That's another thing we discussed with Catherine S., and something which is discussed with by Numa Denis Sustel de Coulanges in Ancient City. That a lot of times, and I heard, Frodi Midyard talking about this, that the ancient paradigm was muscled out by the Christian paradigm, but it wasn't. It wasn't. The ancient pagan paradigm was hollowed out by the philosophers who analyzed it to death, really. So we want to blame someone for everything being edged out. It's you blame Plato, Aristotle, Socrates, even Diogenes, you know, Zeno the Stoic. I forget where exactly he came from.
Ionia or some such place. Hmm? Ionia or some such place.
I think he was on the porch. That's why we called him. You know, Stoics sounds so cool, but they're the porch boy. Is right. Yeah. Right. There is a Turk in chat. I'm going to just ban. And yes, I do understand a little of Turkish. I know you're calling me a donkey, but go fuck yourself. How about that?
I know all the Turkish curse words. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, I mean, it's we were in the same state for 500 years, Turk boy. I know everything you have to say. I was talking about, yeah, they sound cool when they call themselves the Stoic, but it literally means the boys from the porch, the porch philosophers.
Well, you know, Plato is not his name; it's a nickname.
Yeah, it means the fat guy.
No, well,
he's well built,
broad-shouldered one.
He was there was a reconstruction of all of these philosophers, like their faces based on statues and descriptions, and they all come off as dainty and intellectual. And then there's Plato, the miller, right? He looks like he should be hauling millstones from one place to another. He probably did. It's
Socrates was maybe a little light in the loafers or light in the sandals, as it were, but he was certainly no pretty boy.
Yeah, but it's not a question of being pretty. He looks intellectual in the reconstruction of Socrates, yeah. Right? Plato looks like someone who comes to collect for the mafia, right? It looks like he should be answering to Rocco or Mordecai.
Yeah, you know, Socrates is more like Tessio in The Godfather, and Plato is more like Pauly not Costanza, that's a guy from Seinfeld. What's his name? Castellano. No, what was the other guy's name?
Clemenza.
Right, yeah, he's more like Clemenza.
I would say that Plato is really like the most like Willy Chichi, you know, he's a someone pushes a button, someone dies, right?
Push a button, someone dies. Yeah.
Aristotle was
funny. He was a funny guy.
Aristotle is Clemenza, right? He ingratiates himself to power. He's one of these people. Whereas Tessio,
I think, is like Socrates, because remember what they said was, I would have thought it would have been Clemenza. I said, no, it's Tessio. It's a smart thing to do. Right, he was so smart that they figured out he would be the one to do it.
Yeah,
that's what a smart guy.
Although ironically, it was his student Xenophon who actually made the deal with the Barzinis. I mean, the Spartans. And it's right. This is actually doing. I'm looking at.
It was Aristophanes all along. Yes, it was Aristophanes all along.
It was the frogs. The frogs were right. the hens.
Well, this brings up though an issue because you talk about the philosophers hollowing out the gods, and right. There was something this guy.
It wasn't even the hollowing out the gods. They were hollowing out this whole notion that man is bound to his land, that he should worship his ancestors and the gods of the city, and this orthopractic way. So you can very visibly see this in the dialogue with. Whoa, what's his name? Euphemio. Euthemio.
Euthyphro,
yeah. When Socrates is on his way to get whacked by Michael Corleone. So like he's asking Euthemio, hey, remember why are you doing
Corleone
this?
Michael Corleone whacked Socrates? Yeah, that was my favorite scene, yeah.
Right, anyways. Yeah, he got the Mo Green special through the eye. But
it's a Sicilian message. It's a Socrates sleeps with the fishes.
I'm sorry. I'm trying to make a substantive point and yeah, making you laugh. Like this yeah, is a your, very
make
very
your point. Personal. Make your little point. Go ahead.
I'm gonna make my point. Where you see in that dialogue, Eurythero is off to honor his father or kill his father. I forget which. I think
he wants his father tried for heresy. Actually, I think impiety.
And an impiety means that his father effed up the orthopraxy, the proper rituals necessary for giving funeral repasts or maybe worshiping the city gods. You know, it could be any one of these things. And Socrates keeps asking him, why do you believe so? Do you believe the gods will do this? Do you believe that? And it's not a question of belief with Eurythero, right? Urethra. It's not really a question of belief with him. It's a question of it's what you do if you're a good Athenian. To not do that, it's to be a bad Athenian. Like it's a Sicilian message, right? You understand what I'm saying?
It's a Sicilian kind of thing. This cosa nostra.
Right? It's an Athenian thing, right? Yeah. This thing of ours. This is what we do. Guys who are in with the crowd, they do this. But it sounds stupid. But this is what the ancient faith was. And Socrates is like, why are you doing this? You give me a reason why are you doing this. You know, you got to give me a definition. Now, Eurythero, he does not know, and people just don't know. Religion is kind of the thing you don't know. You take a leap of faith. And but by putting that worm of doubt in everyone's minds, you know, Socrates, there's a reason he got whacked. There's a reason they had him whacked. It's not a...
It sounds like you're saying Socrates is a Jew.
I'm saying that Socrates is the Socratic man described by Spengler who arrives when a civilization enter senescence.
That's why they use the Socratic method in law school. That's where all the lawyers come from.
Right. Yeah. I mean, people are always going to say, oh, Christianity, Jewish subversion ruined the classical civilization. No, it wasn't. The classical civilization already lost its spiritual core. It was already hollowed out by these philosophers, and not just Socrates. I mean, Plato, Aristotle, what's his name? Everyone else before Christianity was, you know, ever conceived of.
You're starting to sound like Leo Strauss. You know, he was a Jew.
Yeah.
Leo Strauss.
But he was one of the good ones, right?
He was one of the good ones. Oh, that's
the
good
one. He was the Jew Nazi, right?
Yeah. Well, some people would say he's such a Jew that nobody knows what he meant by anything he wrote. So that's how big a Jew he was.
That's a whole new level. I
wrote like 15 volumes of collected works, and they're still trying to figure out what the fuck he was talking about. But anyway.
I think he was just trying to order kosher latkes, right? It's one of these miscommunications. See, that's the thing. When the Sicilian message was, I don't want this spaghetti bolognese needs more mincemeat. That's the Sicilian message. And Sicilians, they eat fish with pasta.
You mentioned latkes, and that that reminds me of the lackeys that's in the article here by Peter Hempel, if I'm saying that correctly. I wanted to bring that up because it maybe even just as one last thing, if we're running out of time, maybe. But I thought it was a very good section because it comment he, or phrase he has here that because what we've been talking about, you know, people saying, oh, well, you know, we need religion, we need Christianity, and the philosophers were bad because they hollowed out religion and blah, blah, blah. Here's what he says. It was only in the relatively short historical period of the European Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution that the tables were turned. The West, without Enlightenment ideals in its scientific and technological practices, is clearly the weaker one. In other words, if we are the only time we outpaced our enemies was because of the Enlightenment and science and technology and so on. That's where the West pulled in advance. Now you can say, well, you know, there's some people who say that's because Christianity taught there was one God and natural laws and things. Whatever. It wasn't until, you know, the 1400s, the Renaissance and all that, that we had this stuff going. It wasn't until the 18th century we had the Enlightenment. If we take all that away and say, oh, it's terrible, we should go back to the Middle Ages as let me just finish one sentence. If we, because in that same article or in another article, I can't see which one I'm trying to find, but there was another one of the articles you were suggested looking at that starts with a quote from Evola. And saying that basically Evola's idea that the Middle Ages was the Golden Age,
and Christianity contra humanism, which is the counterpoint of Robert Hampton's article about the Christian worldview.
Yeah, but also the Peter Hampel one, because Hampel is explicitly saying no, Evola is wrong. If we go back to the Middle Ages, we become second fiddle to Islam and China and all the other places. The only reason we advanced beyond them, the only reason we got in control of the world is because of the Enlightenment. Now, of course, Brother Stair would say, that's the world is evil, the world is satanic, you shouldn't be doing technology, you should put your faith in God. And so on. Okay, that's one strand of Christianity. So those people are perfectly happy to let us sink away into irrelevance.
I will say, James, that this was really, you could say it was possible because the medieval Christian kingdoms banded together and broke the back of the caliphate with the Crusades, right? The Crusades were never really about, they were about the Holy Land on their face, but in actuality, they were about destroying the caliphate as organized political Islam of the time. And they were, to a great degree, successful. They did provoke a reaction from Salahuddin, but it never really came to anything. And then the Mongols put the caliphate out of its misery after it was no longer a credible political threat to Europe, right? So that is the great success of the Middle Ages there. It destroyed the primary civilizational rival of the West. And after that, you had the Turks, but they were really full gas and neutral. They did steamroll over the Byzantine Empire and the Serbian Empire and all of these states in the Balkans. And that's something the effects of which we can feel to this very day here in the Balkans. But ultimately, Islam was defeated in by the time of the Third Crusade as a political force. And that was the great achievement of the Middle Ages, which allowed the economic and artistic and technological advancements of the Enlightenment and everything. So I'm going to say I'm being Evola here.
No, they weren't fighting for the Enlightenment. That was only accidental. That was.
No. They were fighting a war of self-defense. But vanquishing this major civilizational foe, they paved the way. Like the warrior clears the path for the scientists and the merchant and the artist to do their work, because they can't do their work if they're, you know, constantly running from the Muslim hordes.
Well, but here's, you know, as an aside here, if you want to talk about historical accidents and so on, if I'm not mistaken, I'm no expert in this period or any period for that matter. And when Islam was decisively defeated, I don't know when, if ever. I mean, obviously it was thrown back from the gates of Vienna and Spain reconquered Grenada and so on and all that. But was it not one of the Crusades as a result of which the death blow was delivered to Constantinople? Yeah, and was it not as a result of that that scholars fled from Constantinople to Italy and set off the Renaissance?
Yeah, it's the Venetians basically bribed the Crusaders into destroying Constantinople.
Oh, right. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The Byzantine Empire.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's another thing, right? The Byzantine Empire, I considered it an aspect of classical civilization frozen in its winter stage, which would also make it a rival to the West, right? Classical is not Western civilization. They're two different things. And so for the West to thrive, Byzantium had to fall along with the caliphate. You know, that's something to think about.
Well, yeah. Are you familiar with the theories of those that have been advanced that the original Roman Empire was the so-called Eastern Empire, that the Western Empire was a later
illusion? Yeah, I read the revisionist texts you sent me.
Yeah,
and it's a shame because I actually have it with I don't have a link so that the audience can read. However, I think it's one of those things. I'm pretty much an amateur with regard to the archaeology and all these things, but the linguistic evidence he presents, this is something, you know, I understand more or less, is very flimsy, even contradictory in many places. So it's a good story, as good story as any.
But that's, you know, there's another revisionist thing. I don't know if it's part of this or not, but that sounds like something you were talking about before, about Koine Greek, namely the idea that apparently Dante had as well, that Latin was not the origin of the Romance languages, but there were Romance languages, and Latin was an artificial language that was created at the end of the Dark Ages, I guess, the start of the Middle Ages, for exactly the reasons you would have Esperanto or English or something like that. They took these languages and they created an artificial language that everyone could understand. So that's the linguistic tree that goes from the Romance languages to Latin, not the other way around. So there.
That's very interesting.
This opens all those rabbit holes about what do we actually know about history. And that gets back to Hunter Thompson. I mean, a lot of these people were the Hunter Thompsons of their day, you know? Writing interesting stories or what they knew must have happened.
There is a meme floating around on the internet about how contemporary historians just dive into documents and testimony and physical evidence, whereas ancient historians would say, oh, so my cousin had a dream. No, my cousin met a man who had a dream. Here's what happened in that dream, right? About the historical event, obviously.
Yes. Well, not reported on. They would actually be... The original Greek historians were still very much like Hunter Thompson because they had no documents. So, you know, when they wanted to say, you know, what did Pericles say when he addressed the Athenians? Well, he must have said this. You know, he was naked except for a pair of jack boots. And he, you know, if they thought that would have flown, they would have said that, you know, because they were just, you know, whatever seemed appropriate. You know, this is what he must have said. So
the Melitaeans are pimps. They never would have attacked at Salamis. But I should have known it was the Persians all along. So that's obviously
it's the Athenians all along.
Right. It's we've been going for 3 hours and 11 minutes. I'm sure that number is somehow pretentious and important, but I cannot be bothered to look into it. So, James, we are cut off from entropy. I cannot read if we've gotten any super chats. It's a shame because it's usually a very good service. We have gotten 2 Ninja Guineas from Alyaska Chaga. Thank you, sir, and for keeping me smothered in fungal tea. It's actually pretty good. It's full of antioxidants, helps me sleep, helps me with the motor mouth. And Hadrian was right. And, of course, Hadrian was right. The Scots do need to be kept behind a great, beautiful wall. Hadrian was right, donates a diamond. Thank you for that, kind sir. And that is greatly appreciated. James, I'm about to sign off. I'm about to end the show. You got any closing remarks? And let's keep them brief. And yes, we do understand that Hunter Thompson is awesome.
Well, get it while you can, but don't get caught. That's about all I can say at this point. It's always an enjoyable chat. Hope the listeners get much out of it. As always, these are just my opinions. And occasionally I can point to something online or a book somewhere. But otherwise, I'm just trying to make my way through this crazy world of ours, this madcap existence we have, and just offering some views and willing to entertain contrary views up to a point. So there we are. And keep reading Countercurrents and keep watching the skies.
It's great advice. It's marvelous advice. Thank you, Mr. James O'Meara, for being with us tonight. For anyone just tuning in, this has been the Writer's Block, 3 hours, 13 minutes of when we have decided that, yes, indeed, there's a lot of Jews out there. There's also a lot of
basically, Italians. It all boils down to that. There's a lot of Jews out there. So
yeah. Those Greeks too. You know, they were basically like the Italians, anyways. And so this has been the Writer's Block, and I want to thank James for being with us. I want to thank our moderators, Gaius Maximus and Bartleby, and thank you for dominating chat, just keeping everyone at bay, keeping those Turks at bay. You are modern day Charles Martels. And I want to thank everyone who donated. I want to thank everyone who tuned in, everyone listening to the replay over at countercurrents.com. And I guess this is it. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
See you, people.